gambling disorder has the highest rates of all the disorders. If I stop using alcohol today, I can go build my life back tomorrow. If I stop gambling today, I still have 2, 3, 4 times my annual salary in debt. I'm continuing to go and I'm staying longer than I had intended to. And now my friends are starting to get annoyed with me and saying, hey, it's time to go home. So I start isolating. People are dying now. We don't need to wait for it to get even further out of hand. If we see that as a problem where people are dying, how do we fund it at a level that permits that to happen?
Welcome back to the One Day at a Time podcast. My name's Rob and I'm in recovery from a gambling addiction. We've been working on a documentary here on the channel, which is going to be coming out very soon. But one of the interviews from that documentary that we shot was just too good to not use. So I want to introduce Dr. Ken Martz. We had a cool conversation about the future of gambling in the United States and what actually happens in the brain of a problem gambler. Hope you enjoy.
So I think the question that's on a lot of people's mind when they first hear about gambling addiction is, how can you get addicted to gambling? There's no substance involved. Can you explain what's going on in the brain?
Sure. So our brain is designed to watch out for danger and learn things along the way that will protect us, particularly things that would be of danger, but other learning as well. So there's two ways that the brain does that. One is by intense emotions. So for example, when I see a tiger and I run away, when I touch a hot stove, I get burned into my brain, so I don't need to go touch the hot stove 20 times to learn that I don't do this. And so therefore, there are other times when, for example, if I have a big win and I'm gambling and I'm gambling socially and I suddenly have a big win, it cues the brain of that intense emotional response to cue a strong memory, a strong emotionally based memory. The other method is through the repetition. So as I practice gambling, very often folks would be practicing gambling for some 10 years of their addictive process before they come in to see me. There would very often be, again, just like learning your times tables in grade school, the repetition wires the brain to learn some things so it's efficient. So it's for safety or efficiency. So the brain is designed to internally run on ways that we naturally do. One of the things that's happening there is that the brain is set up to be efficient and to function ahead of that, ourselves that way. So there's no drug outside of us, but it does cue the electrical model within the brain as well as the neurochemistry within the brain. So as it keeps refiring the same neurotransmitters, there is a neurotransmitter in the brain that is getting reused, for example, dopamine, for example, epinephrine, some things like that that you may have heard of that the brain then, again, begins to crave. So there's an internal chemical process as well, even though there's no external chemical for gambling.
So the gambling itself is actually changing the physical structure of the brain.
Yes, yes. Every thought we have, every repeated learning we have is rewiring the brain to make that learning, to make it function. So that whatever is familiar, we don't have to think about it. It's kind of like when you're driving, you don't actually pay attention to all the micro movements that you're doing when you're driving. It becomes almost automatic. Now, that is very helpful for us with helpful activities such as driving or answering the phone, but it is not useful for things like issues that become addictive, such as process disorders, gambling, alcohol, other drugs, etc.
What makes it addictive, though? Is it like you get used to feeling good because that fire is in your brain? Or like what happens to actually get someone hooked to gambling?
Sure. There are multiple paths into the process. So everything from genetic predispositions to that early exposure. The brain is trained into that from an earlier age, so it is prepared for those issues. There is some genetics point to the dopamine receptor as well, so that the brain may be predisposed even in some individuals long before they're even aware of this as a conversation. At the next level, there's multiple levels throughout, one of which is simple exposure, and then under what conditions and what function does it serve for them. So for example, for some individuals, I'm going out to the casino, for example, with my friends, and we're going out to play poker together. And so there's a social element to it. Or a nursing home, and they have a whole bus of the individuals going all together as an outing event. Sometimes the learning begins as a social pleasure, but there's a point at which the fun stops. And I'm continuing to go and I'm staying longer than I intended to. And now my friends are starting to get annoyed with me and saying, hey, it's time to go home. So I start isolating. And so sometimes what starts us in a process may be different than what continues us in that process as well. So for example, I'm looking to escape from something, either my emotional state or other uncomfortable thing, with the hope of something. This is something you see in advertisements all the time. It's like, it could be you. You know, things like that create that sense of hope at a time when people are struggling or feeling hopeless. Mm. So there's multiple pathways in there.
Other than like losing money, which most people would realize makes something not fun, what makes gambling lose its flair over time? Why is it not this great thrill every single time?
Sure. So one of the things we know about from drug addiction is that there's this thing called tolerance. Mm. And so when I repeat something, it loses its edge. So for example, if you have a wonderful piece of cake that was just cooked, and you take a bite, it tastes delicious. And then by the second bite, it tastes a little less so. By the fourth bite, you're back into your conversation, kind of forgotten that you're even eating this delicious cake, which is where in some traditions they'll have small courses so that you can change the flavors, so you can maintain that sensitivity. Anything that we repeat starts to lose some of that novelty over time. And so that is one of the pieces that will lose some of its flair, shall we say.
I want to get back into what you were talking about with advertising. When someone sees a gambling ad on TV, what is happening in their brain? So say it's this commercial telling you that you'll win big, sign up and get this deposit bonus. What's going on in the mind of someone that maybe has a gambling addiction that's seeing that?
Sure. So every memory that's stored in our brain stores the sights, sounds, smells, experience, emotion, etc., all connected across the brain. So if you have a memory from what you had for dinner last night, you remember all the pieces of where you were and time frame, etc. So when I see an ad that has certain sights, sounds, memories that it gets triggered, such as the flash, the lights, the ringing, the winning. It triggers exactly that spot in the brain of that hope of I could win. That could be me. And I remember, for example, the time of the big win that I had. It triggers that part of me that expects the winning, but does not trigger the corresponding, I did that for months and years and lost money. So it selectively triggers a certain spot in the brain.
That kind of begs the question then, if we were to take the opposite approach and be presenting all of the bad things that go on with gambling, does that stop people or does it not work vice versa?
Doesn't work as much vice versa. So for example, we've known for years that cigarettes cause all sorts of ills and started to put them on the warning signs on there. It doesn't stop people from using once they've developed that addictive process. Hmm. There's some value on that in preventing someone from starting, but once I'm into the addictive process, I'm getting pulled along on that autopilot, on that deeply learned behavior pattern. So it's a little bit different for that once they're already developed an addiction process. Mm. We know that the perception of risk is, from a prevention standpoint, is very valuable. You know, we know, we've watched over the years that the perception of risk of nicotine amongst youth, the perception of risk was very high, and whenever that would go down, the rates of nicotine use would go up. Or as the rates of perception of risk for marijuana goes down, the rates of marijuana use have gone up. So we know that the direction of perception of risk directly relates to use for prevention purposes. So it is very helpful to understand those risks at the early stages, just not as much by the later stages.
That makes sense. How long have you been working with patients that have gambling addictions?
I've been working with gambling specialty for about 30 years now. So I started my career there in a treatment program that specialized in gambling. Grew up with them, promoted up through the field, and loved it there. Unfortunately, over time, they had to close over time. There was a number of challenges that faced this field. For example, by the time our folks are coming into treatment, they've already lost a lot of money. So they can't afford it for themselves, and they may have lost their job, which we have an insurance system that is based on what your job is. And so they don't have a way to fund it, and so it becomes problematic for that. In a number of ways. There are a number of insurance-related issues that could be challenging there.
Does insurance cover problem gambling?
It should. There is a difference between having coverage and access versus actually having something covered. So just because I have insurance that covers my medical conditions or mental health conditions, that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm authorized for that care. So for example, there could be exclusionary clauses. They could say that is not deemed medically necessary. They could do some things like you don't need that length of stay that is recommended by the professional, or you may not need the intensity. So you can be better handled with a outpatient setting or a Gamblers Anonymous group instead of clinical care.
Can we talk about something real for a minute? If your gambling has started to feel less like fun and more like stress, trust me, you're not alone. Millions of us know what it's like to say, just one more bet, or feel that urge that's really difficult to explain. That's why I'm excited to tell you about Evive, a sponsor of today's video. Think of it as having a recovery companion right in your pocket, someone who actually understands what you're going through. No lectures, no pressure, just practical tools and genuine support when those challenging moments hit. Download Evive now and you'll get guaranteed free access through 2026. Not a trial or a limited version, but the complete platform, completely free. Because Evive believes that everyone deserves access to support that works for them. Download Evive today and take the first step towards changing your relationship to gambling. Evive is only available in select countries.
So the reason that I asked how long it's been since you've been working with problem gamblers is that things have changed a lot, especially within the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
In the beginning of your work with problem gamblers, what was the stereotypical person that you would work with?
Going back even just a touch before that, there was a time where most of the gamblers were either going to Las Vegas or Atlantic City. And so there really wasn't, there was a lot of difference in that you needed to travel to go to your gambling of choice. You know, there was a few folks who would be coming in for a scratch-offs or lotto, but there was a lot fewer of those back then. So one of the things that was happening is there was much lower frequency availability, and as the lotto moved from being once a week to once a day, to sometimes twice a day, to Keno, to more and more range of things, as well as more and more dollar amounts, you know, the Mega Millions now, there's even more and more of an allure of something more. But the frequency and accessibility has dramatically shifted over the last 30 years. You know, so you don't need to hop on two cars and two flights to get to a gaming venue now. You know, it's kind of like, if I have a peanut allergy and I never eat peanuts, I may never know that I have a peanut allergy. If I have the predisposition to develop a gambling disorder and I never went out to Las Vegas, I may never have known that. When there is now a gaming venue down the street for me or a phone in my pocket, there's exposure to folks that who might have had that peanut allergy that would have never known it in the past, that now is able to get triggered because of the accessibility feature.
So, how has online gambling changed the demographics of problem gambling?
Sure. Earlier on, by the nature of needing to travel and also needing for it to get severe enough that they would go to seek treatment, the demographic of who you would see tended to be just a little bit older. There are still a lot of older folks that are coming into treatment, but there's much more of a younger generation now. Some folks that are starting in their early 20s, the average age of first bet is out there as early as 12. You know, we're not starting earlier enough in educating and identifying the risks and preventing. You know, it's even though it's not legal until you're 18, it doesn't mean that individuals didn't, for example, purchase scratch-offs for the holidays as gifts and things like that, or play cards around the table at the holiday season. It's just a social activity at home. For most folks, that's totally normal and fun. But for someone who has that risk factor, it creates the perceptions of risk that are low, that this is just comfortable and easy and safe. Even from those early ages, we talk to our kids about sex and drugs and alcohol, but not necessarily gambling. And so the education factor doesn't lay them side by side in terms of the risk availability.
I want to backtrack there for a second. You said there were kids as young as 12 that were gambling.
Mm-hmm.
What does that look like for them? Does it look the same as it looks for a 25-year-old?
Well, it'll vary a little bit. For some things, it may be very similar to what it looks like to a 25-year-old because, again, playing cards around the kitchen table or scratch-offs. Or I told grandma to good luck when she goes out to play bingo.
Mm-hmm.
But for most others, it may start much, much simpler. So earlier and earlier ages now, our kids are getting cell phones just for safety purposes so that they can call if they need picked up or things like that. The cell phones often have a range of games on them. Many of the games mimic some of the adult gaming practices. What makes a game fun? The things that make you want to play more. You know, if it doesn't make you want to play more, the game's not going to sell, it's going to be useless, so they're not going to use it. And so the things that make it engaging are exactly the things that make it risky. Now, as games progress, there's a whole range of gaming practices that have everything from make purchases throughout the game so that there can be getting used to swiping the card or making purchases throughout. Now, where do they get the credit card for that? So they're already getting that through mom or dad or other family member to be able to make purchases through their games to purchase gems or points or whatever it may be, or the special activity or the special module. So as you get used to making these purchases without even seeing dollars exchanged, it's just a swipe of a coin, a swipe of the face. How does that then play when I start to shift over towards anything from playing slots on as a game for entertainment purposes only to now it's real money? You know, so some things will look very similar. Others will vary a little bit. So, for example, that may progress when we start to move towards sports betting and something like that, where they're watching the games with their friends. They could even still be betting on the games with their friends.
Are gambling operators using kind of that trend of gamification in their advertising? And, like, what's really going on with gambling advertising?
The purpose of advertising in general is to make someone engaged and desire a little bit more so that they will purchase a product. That's the nature of any advertising, isn't it? If that is what they're doing, that is what they're practicing to engage people into their product. How do you stop someone from gaming once they're moving from that edge from social gambling to problem gambling? And it's not an on-off switch. If the teaching and gaming and gambling is about doing a bit more, having more fun, where is there an intervention there? Where is there a way to know when how much is too much or too little? Because by the time I'm getting there, my brain's already getting trained into a certain pathway, which is very hard to unlearn. You know your timetables from when you were 3 years old or 10 years old in third grade, and you know that 5 times 5 equals 25, can I possibly get you to forget that once you've learned it, once you've practiced it for months and years on end? Once I've learned that gaming is fun, gaming is what I do, it's a little harder to unlearn that, you know, once I've already practiced into that at that level.
Do you think that there's more people that need help for a gambling problem today than there were a decade ago?
Absolutely. Back when I first started, the tradition within drug and alcohol is that if you are getting into recovery, you might go to 90 meetings in 90 days in a self-help tradition. So within Gamblers Anonymous, where I was, there were 7 meetings across the entire state. So even if you wanted to do something like that, there really wasn't even accessibility. There wasn't enough volume of people to fill treatment programs or self-help support groups at that stage. Now they are all over as well as online. We know that there has been an increase through the years, and I haven't seen the latest demographics, but across the board, especially since COVID, and there was a range of impacts that had, from delaying treatment so that some individuals might have gotten more severe, as well as all the things that we know can be triggers of fear, loss, grief if individuals died, isolation. We've seen that across the board, across multiple types of systems, from medical system to mental health systems to addiction treatment programs. Throughout COVID, some things got much worse. There was a severity as well as a increase in accessibility, just because when you couldn't go out and do anything, what did you do to fill your time? So people started filling their time with some things that were otherwise safe, but could have been developed into something along that way too.
Is online gambling inherently more addictive than in-person gambling?
Inherently is a tricky term. The in-person has a very immersive element to it. However, the online or particularly on the phone, it's in my pocket. The accessibility really increases the frequency of use. You know, if I have to drive 20 minutes to a gaming venue, that still delays things and slows down the frequency. One of the things that we know is that the higher the rates of frequency of the gaming, the more of a pull it seems to do. So if it's in my pocket, I can play and play and play at any hour of the day. The accessibility of it makes it more engaging.
If we're seeing a trend where gambling is happening at a higher frequency, more people are struggling, what will happen in our nation if nothing changes?
Right. So it used to be that there was much less of an awareness even of gambling as a problem. And so I would often say that gambling as an addiction process was about 10 to 20 years behind drug and alcohol in the public awareness. And that seems to be tracking as well, as it is increased over time, just as drug and alcohol has spread. So for example, there was a time I mentioned about the availability of support groups. It used to be that people used to think that gamblers were just bad, or why don't you just stop? I've actually had somebody with an alcohol use disorder turn to individuals with a gambling disorder and say, why don't you just stop? So there's not a public understanding of it as an addiction process. And as that is increasing, as people are more and more getting to know people who have a gambling problem, that awareness is helping to identify folks as well as to destigmatize it a bit as well. So it is becoming more pervasive over time as it continues to expand in availability and the numbers. So for example, with each different mode of gambling, it is also increasing the rate of gambling disorder. Mm. So for example, if I might be triggered by sports betting, the more I'm accessible to sports betting, the more that 1, 2, 3, 4% of the population will begin sports betting as an addictive process. If that's not a risk to me, I might think sporting events are boring. But I might, when a casino or a gaming casino or a casino on access slot access on my phone might trigger me. So that may be more engaging to another set of populations. So the more types of venues, the more an individual is apt to have a range of increase in the rates of addiction. Just like some people were apt to get addicted to cocaine and others are addicted to sedatives, different venues will be slightly more of a call to certain individuals.
So it's fair to say that as there's more gambling, there will be more gambling problems.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And why can't an addicted gambler just stop?
Yeah, so it's kind of like when you're going down the river, first you get in, it feels good, you're swimming around. You know, if there's a point at which, if you get onto the Niagara Falls, there's a point at which the river will start to pull you down. And there's even a sign there that will say, don't go past this point, otherwise the river will pull you on from here. So once you develop that level of a internal drive, that's the principle of addiction, is that I've lost my sense of control of it. And I sometimes at that point, if I move beyond that point on the river where the river is going to pull me forward, whether even against my will, at some point I may need somebody from outside sources to help to airlift me out of that river. And that's part of the process of development. So I need those spaces where I can get help even when I'm not able to help myself at a certain point. As it evolves, I've isolated from my friends, I've maybe stolen from my friends or families. And so as I further and further travel down that river, I have less resources to be able to get back out on my own. I often say that addictions are a disease of hopelessness and disease of isolation. You know, when we isolate ourselves from all of our relationships, it becomes harder and harder to get your way back out. And plus, I may have tried to stop, and I don't believe that there's any hope out there. So, but there is hope, because, of course, as you will see in the ad or the mention, that this is where it could be you, or other such phrases of this one person won, and which is awesome, also a common place of advertising, and the place that it is hope, because I'm not going to play a game in order to lose. Mm. I'm playing for the purpose of maybe winning.
So the advertisements, to an extent, take advantage of the worst aspects of addiction?
Yeah, it begins to trigger the piece that's pulling you forward. So when I first start playing, I am going to spend $20, $40, $100, just as if I was going to go out to a dinner, an expensive movie and show. As I go further along the way, I'm now in debt. And now I'm more and more debt. Very often, individuals that come to see me often have two, three, sometimes four times their salary in debt. And so they begin to see that money is not the problem, the gambling is not the problem, that they have a money problem, that the gambling is the only solution to their money problem. Mm. I have so much crushing debt that the only way out is for me to go and make that big win again. So the hope of the gambling becomes the exit strategy rather than a problem. The tunnel vision begins to get even worse, where the further I travel down that road of the addiction process, the same thing that gave me hope to start becomes the chains that bind me there.
What needs to change in a psychological sense about advertising to make sure that problem gamblers are protected?
Right. So one of the things to think about is being careful about who it's regulated by, how it's regulated. Is it all done by the goodwill of the industry? Or are there other agencies that have a counterbalance to make sure that something is not, for example, targeting children or inadvertently targeting children or making something an inappropriate expectation of the risk? So, for example, sometimes it can give a perception of a result that's not typical, and that would be flagged by the FEC. So it would be, there are other agencies that would otherwise step in as a consumer protection when you are advertising something that is potentially more out of line with what's actually results that are typical.
Gambling can absolutely wreck your finances, but you don't have to fix it alone. At GamFin, they help people struggling with gambling debt to take back control. Whether it's budgeting, debt management, or rebuilding your financial future, their experts are here with real solutions. No judgment, just support. Your money doesn't have to define you. Visit GamFin.org today and take the first step toward financial recovery by meeting with one of their financial advisors. Hope starts here.
In regards to the gambling itself, it appears that a trend we're seeing is that it's getting faster, it's getting more engaging, and the stakes are getting higher.
Right.
Is this trend something that needs to change, or is there something else that needs to happen to protect problem gamblers?
Well, one of the challenges that you've got is that there will be a free speech and liberty argument that's made that, well, for those who are gaming or gambling socially, how do they have access to the thing that they are simply enjoying? And from an advertising standpoint, trying to get people to do a little bit more. And within that scope, there's some space for it. But how do you draw that line? Because the same people who are using it socially are also watching the same ads as the people who have a gambling addiction. Mm-hmm. And so it's impossible to draw an ad that doesn't hit both those with an addiction as well as those that are earlier on in that pipeline. And so is there a way to think about what type of marketing or protections could be most triggering of that severe end? And do we need to move marketing that would be a little bit less engaging for those individuals? The challenge of it is that, again, any marketing is designed for the purpose of awareness and exposure and engagement of the product. It's difficult to do that without triggering at the same time those who are most at risk and most severe.
Between the mass marketing of gambling and the increased pace of play, which is a more pressing issue for legislators to take on first as it relates to problem gambling?
Within problem gambling, the increased rates are probably more urgent simply because it is going to be very directly at the individuals who are going to the more severe end. The advertising will hit a little bit closer to the front end and be a trigger for those who are already in there, but it's not as much of a new risk to them if they've already developed the addiction process. The ad pulls them back in when they're trying to get out. But it's not causing them to get further into the addiction. The repetition, the speed of play is much more pervasive all the way throughout.
And are there some like general guidelines that you would recommend to prevent people from even developing a gambling problem?
Sure. So much like advertising may engage someone into gambling, there are prevention services that we do regularly and even research-based, evidence-based prevention programs that can be done in grade school, in high school, to teach kids about the risks associated, how to say no to my friends if they're trying to push me to do something that I do not want to do or would be risky for me to do, whether that's drugs, alcohol, gambling, or other behaviors. So there are a number of ways to help prevent at those early ages, as well as to raise the awareness for parents so that they know what they're doing and the risks that are associated when they decide whether or not to permit certain apps or how they monitor the phones or what age to go through the phones. Because we know that the earlier the exposure there is to certain types of gaming, the more risks that are associated with it. So the other thing to think about is that that's the prevention element. The next layer, though, is the accessibility of treatment. You know, we do not have enough counselors, the funding for them at all levels of care, from outpatient all the way through to residential, that like we do, for example, on the drug and alcohol side. There is a full spectrum of care for the different levels of severity. You know, and we're not there yet with gambling. So there's much more limited resources so that someone can see someone with a specialty, see someone with the expertise to know how to help them. So need everything from prevention all the way through to treatment, as well as some of the things that we see out there that are social concerns that may contribute, such as other depression, trauma, socioeconomic status standards, etc., that could be contributing factors as well.
So it's about getting to the root causes earlier on than we have been.
Yes, absolutely.
What groups particularly should be taking action and what can they do?
Gotcha. So as parents, we can educate ourselves and begin to teach our kids everything from emotional awareness, trigger awareness, the risks associated with the range of things that they can be coming in contact with, just as we can be doing as educators in schools, et cetera, there. So all the way throughout, there will be a range of steps to be able to address things. So one of the other ways to think about that is that from a public policy standpoint, how do we begin to make sure that there are resources that are associated? So very often, as states have gotten the legalization of additional forms of gambling, they have done so with the promise of a percentage of this is going to go to help with your taxes. It's going to go to help teachers to have students' textbooks. It will go to help our older adults. The gambling revenue gets sold as a means to balance a budget and make other gains. But knowing that there is a percentage of risk associated with it, how do we make sure that there is an adequate funding out of that stream that goes to address the harms that are associated? So one of the challenges is that schools and teachers and treatment programs, these all cost money. So how do we make sure that out of the revenues that are getting brought in, that people can't get the treatment that they need, when they need it, how they need it, in the intensity and duration that they need it? So how do we create a system where people can access the supports that they need as well? And so that would be more of a legislative type of fix to make sure that as we look at state budgets or federal budgets, how do we ensure that certain things get funded at the level of the risk that it's causing? We know that gambling disorder has the highest rates of suicide of all the disorders, part because of the hopelessness. And like I said, about the high rates of debt that I may incur because of it. If I stop using alcohol today, I can go build my life back tomorrow. If I stop gambling today, I still have 2, 3, 4 times my annual salary in debt, figuring out how to deal with and dig out of for years to come. So the level of hopelessness there creates a severity, which is very risky for suicide, depression, and a whole risk of other ills. If you see that as a problem, if you see that as a challenge for our communities, and there is also a crossover addiction process as well. So as one goes up, the others are also following up. If we see that as a problem where people are dying, how do we fund it at a level that permits that to happen and to get the supports that they need?
Noting that problem gambling has such a high risk of suicide and that it's a really pressing issue right now and it's growing in popularity, what should gambling operators be doing? What would you like to see them doing to reduce the risk to problem gamblers?
Sure. There are a number of things that they can be doing to help reduce the risks of harm, such as maintaining the awareness, training their staff, education for the community, and doing it in a robust manner, not just here's a flyer on the side, but making a very active intent for that, particularly because there's a thin line between when the fun stops and becomes problematic. So really having a robust educational and even treatment programming aspects. They don't want people to be passed away. So how do they manage that and set aside standards that help to really protect against that, which we all agree on anyway? They don't want individuals to commit suicide. They don't want parents with a gambling disorder to leave their babies in the car and have them die in the car. So how do we begin to maintain a robust element, as robust as you're trying to get people in the door, to protect them from the back end as well?
Are the steps that casino operators are currently taking in regards to responsible gambling enough to help problem gamblers?
At this point, we know that there is so much more work to be done, and really would like to see that to continue to grow because we want to stay ahead of this. We don't want to wait until this becomes the next opioid epidemic before we start to treat it in that manner. Mm. So people are dying now. We don't need to wait for it to get even further out of hand before we go to raise our alarm bells. We want to be preventive rather than being in the situation where we're at with the opioid epidemic, where we are chasing it after the fact. You know, the opioid epidemic, one of the identified causes has been back even in the early 2000s. We saw pain as a vital sign. We tried to protect people from experiencing pain. We didn't want them to experience pain, so we said, well, this is a safe and effective approach, is to provide certain opioids. It's now 20 years later before we began to understand and the expanded risk of that. Now we have the opioid epidemic where so much press has gone to how many people are dying on a daily basis and really trying to reel in a pack of dogs that it's got run away from us. Mm. You know, it's easier to do prevention when it's a smaller system than we're trying to get something that's gotten out of control in a public policy matter. If gambling were, for example, 10 or 20 years behind the addiction process for opioids or alcohol, we can begin to see a similar process here as it's been expanding. We don't want to wait until it gets to the level of the opioid epidemic before we really step up our efforts to a point that matches the risks associated.
In going along that metaphor, if opioids were the solution to pain, what is gambling being pitched as the solution to?
Gambling is often felt as the solution to my money problems or my emotional problems at times. You know, it's fun, it's pleasure, it's play, it's the escape from your daily life. It could be you who gets to have the yacht and the large house. That's not something that is being pitched to someone who already has multiple millions of dollars. That's being pitched to someone for whom that is a dream, for whom that is a hope, that is the escape from what they're experiencing in their day-to-day. When some people are struggling over the price of groceries on a daily basis, that hope of freedom is an escape from the today's reality.
So who should I talk to next to find out more answers about how to help problem gamblers, or what's the risk if we don't?
One of the challenges that we've got is that there are fewer people that are experts and aware of this. There are a few conferences that are significant around where experts tend to collect, but as you find the individuals who are have knowledge of this and perhaps have done some treatment or prevention programming, one of the next steps will be how to educate, as I said, parents, teachers, and our legislators so that we can begin to bring change in ways that will be protective and effective.
Thank you so much for watching. And if you want to hear a story of someone in recovery from a gambling addiction, then check out this video and let's keep getting better together one day at a time.